with us this morning. And I know a lot of you haven't met him and you don't know the relationship. Really, he's kind of my pastor. He's the pastor of all the pastors in our area, in our district, in the Christian Missionary Alliance. And he's a great man of God. We're privileged to have him. Lord bless you, Jeff. And before you leave today, if you have any questions about how we are as an organization, function, or anything, please ask him. He'd be delighted. He's in no rush, so blessings upon you today as you share. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome.
Greatly appreciate the opportunity for my wife Pam and I to be here with you all and have an opportunity to share in God's Word. Equally had the delight in just sharing and the good things that God is doing here. We spent, as you know, the Friday night and Saturday with your staff as a bit of a retreat, and that was fun and life-giving for us. We laughed a lot. We learned some things. We ate too much food, and we just really enjoyed each other's company. That was delightful. It was a real delight as well to be with your adult Sunday school class this morning, a chance to dig into some of these things about who we are. You're part of a worldwide movement. Some 20-plus thousand churches around the globe, 6 million people who call the Christian Missionary Alliance home, and you've had a key role in that. As a matter of fact, this worldwide movement has been done and worked by the power of the Holy Spirit on the shoulders of obedient people who go out on the faithful resourcing of churches like yourself. Since 1986, this church has given over $2 million to the worldwide work of the Christian Missionary Alliance. Thank you for that. That's right. And rejoice in all those things that God is doing and your part in that. I know it's far more than just your offerings. It's your commitment to send, your commitment to go, and even your commitment to see the harvest field that's all around you. I'm excited about the workshop you'll have next Saturday. I hope many of you will come to that. We talked earlier today. There's about 12,000 people live within 2.5 miles of where I'm standing right now. And if the statistics are anywhere near correct, then about 10,000 of them have no meaningful relationship with Jesus Christ or his church. And you get to have a difference and an influence in that. And so I'm excited that this church takes that seriously and longs to be a part of God's work both here and there and everywhere around the world. Thanks for your part in all of that. And I've asked the Lord to maybe use a little bit of the message today to spur some of you. I'm not sure how that might be. As a matter of fact, I find I'm pretty lousy at predicting those things. The Spirit of God does what he wants to do. But you're going to hear from one of the Old Testament stories. I love the Old Testament stories that are left to be an example to us, to motivate and inspire us to catalyze things that God may want to do. And I would pray that in the same way that there was a person in a story today that woke up one morning and thought, I think the Lord might want me to do this. That maybe there's some of you here today that would hear the voice of the Lord say to you, I think I'm supposed to do whatever it is. Or maybe it's been something you've heard from the Lord before and you've been hesitant, you weren't sure. You know, you have that thing, like, I think I heard from God, I'm not totally sure. Maybe that would be just ratified in your heart today as we walk through this. So we're going to walk a little bit of a journey together. I'm going to start, I just need to brag a little bit. Some of you didn't know that I was a great military strategist, but I am. And my friend Scott and I, we were partners in this together, and we never lost a battle. Never once. Now, admittedly, we were elementary kids. So on Saturdays, Scott and I, he lived 3 houses down from me. And some Saturdays we go to his house, some Saturdays we go to my house, and we invariably did the same thing on Saturday afternoon. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and so at a Cleveland TV station, every Saturday afternoon was Superhost Mad Theater. You ought not to get overly excited about it. It was really bad movies. They were the old Godzilla and Japanese monster movies, right, where the lips don't match with what the person's saying, and there's these little plastic trucks and cars that are their special effects and all this stuff. And we would watch these movies, but they had long commercial breaks. They, like, dragged this show out forever. And so there's long commercial breaks that would bore us to death. And so we did battle, my basement or his basement. We set up these massive battle scenes, us against some opposing me. We would leverage everything we had. There was the Huey helicopter that I had built. Was one of my first models that I made. A Huey helicopter that served ever so faithfully until the day I accidentally sat on it. There was the DC-9, so early plane, commuter jet plane, that was conscripted into military duty for bombing runs that we would have. There was the aircraft carrier that I built, the USS Forrestal, that would carry far more than just planes into battle. And then we would just conscript any kind of thing that we could into all of this. There was walls and barriers and bridges built out of building blocks. There was the Lincoln Log HQ that helped us to be our center of everything. There was my sister's little play school bus that would carry soldiers into battle, including her Weebles that wobble but don't fall down. You could not kill them, all right? And we had those little green soldiers, you know, that were always, just didn't matter what, they didn't really move. They just were always in the same position. And best of all, we had several of the action figures of G.I. Joe with a fuzzy beard and head. They were our special forces. And we never lost a battle. Every single one, we were amazingly successful. We were the gods, small g gods, of the battlefield. And by the way, we never once postured ourselves in a defensive stance. We were about conquest. We were about taking new territory. We were always moving forward. We were kicking out the bad guys, moving into fresh places, wherever that was in the basement. And away we went. Two young kids, masters of forward movement in conquest. And I just think that maybe somewhere along the line, a whole bunch of us grew up and stopped having the mentality of some of these young children like Scott and myself, who were so sure that every battle that mattered, we would win. Now, I realize we're in an interesting world, but I just want us to think a little bit about the battles that the Lord may have for us. Because if the battle is of the Lord, then the Lord is the Lord of the battle. So I want us to look at a story. You can just listen if you want. You can go back with me to the Old Testament, the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 14. I'm not sure where 1 Samuel is. It's right after, or right before 2 Samuel. I'm here for you. You go back, you get the first five books of the Bible, and then you get Joshua and Judges, and then you get to the first and seconds. First, second Samuel, there's Chronicles and Kings as well, first and seconds of them. 1 Samuel chapter 14, I'm actually going to read the last sentence of chapter 13. It should have gone with chapter 14, and then just the first 14 verses here. It says, "Now a detachment of the Philistines," and I don't know if you grew up in church, but if you grew up in church, every time you hear the word Philistines, you ought to just go, oh, you know, they were the evil henchmen. They're the bad people. They're the arch enemies always of God's people. So the Philistines are always the bad enemy, and here they are as well in this story as well. So the detachment of the Philistines had gone out to the pass at Michmash. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, who was the king, Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men, among whom was, I get to see all the fun words here. This is actually really fun because you're going to be impressed that I know how to say all these names. You just don't really know if I say them right or not. I can say them any way I want, and as long as I sound confident, you're going to be impressed, right? Okay? So among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. He was the son of Ichabod's brother Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. No one was aware that Jonathan had left. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez, and the other was Senah. One cliff stood to the north toward Michmash, the other to the south toward Geba. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised men. Here's key sentence coming up. Key sentence in the whole story. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. Do all that you have in mind, his armor bearer said. Go ahead, I am with you, heart and soul. Jonathan said, come on then, we will cross over toward them and let them see us. If they say to us, wait there till we come up to you, then we will stay where we are and we will not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands. So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. Look, the Philistines said, the Hebrews are crawling out from the holes they're hiding in. And the men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan, his armor bearer, come on up here to us, and we're going to teach you a lesson. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet, with his armor bearer right behind him. And the Philistines fell before Jonathan. His armor bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan, his armor bearer, killed some 20 men in an area about half an acre. This is a fascinating story that we have before us. And I want to talk a little bit about conquest today. So, first, let's talk about the place of conquest. What was the context, the place of context of conquest that we have here in this story? Here's a couple things you need to know about this place of conquest. First, the economy was terrible. If you were to read the stories, the chapters before this, you'd find out that whatever you and I think about recession or inflation or whatever, it was nothing compared to what they faced then. Their economy was in the dumpster. It was not good. They were oppressed. They were under the thumb of the Philistines. As a matter of fact, it tells us that in the whole army of the Israelite people, there was only two swords. Well, guess who got the two swords? The king, Saul, and his son, the general, Jonathan. Everybody else had sticks, pitchforks, shovels, you know, they're just doing the best they can with whatever they can come up with. There's only two swords. Because the Philistines, the oppressors, took over the whole iron industry, and they made it so that you couldn't have anything of those kind of weapons, and you couldn't forge, you couldn't make, you couldn't sharpen. And if you wanted to get something like your plow done for farming, you had to go to the Philistines to do it. So they had a monopoly on all of this. It's a difficult circumstance. And they were taxed. You think you don't like your taxes? They were taxed in outrageous ways. They were weak. They were weak. It tells us in verse 2 of chapter 13 that there was about 3,000 Israelite soldiers. But you heard me read in verse 2 of chapter 14 that there's only 600. So in just one chapter's time, they've had, was that two-thirds of their army go AWOL? They've run for their lives. They're scared to death. Why? Because in chapter 13, it tells us that the Philistine army that was camped out against them outnumbered the sands of the sea. In other words, they were uncountable. So you got 600 versus tens and tens of thousands of enemy soldiers, two swords against chariots and arrows and swords and other weaponry. This is a circumstance they faced. This was the context, the place of their conquest. But it was even worse than that. Their government was a weak government. Saul was supposed to be God's leader. He was supposed to depend upon God and experience the power of God. And he wasn't doing so well at that. He was a deeply flawed leader. And we find him sitting up under the pomegranate trees when he ought to have been a man of leadership and action and trust in God. Remember all those names I read? The ones that are hard to pronounce? You go, well, what's that really matter for the story? If you're like me, sometimes you'd read through those things like, let me just keep reading and skim this and get to the good stuff. Well, what's this really all about? I'm just going to make this prediction. It all hinges on the name Ichabod. The Ichabod name is there in the middle of that. This is the religious leadership, by the way, the priesthood. And the name Ichabod, there's an interesting story about that you can find in Samuel. The name Ichabod means the glory has departed. In other words, their governmental leadership was weak and ungodly. Their religious leadership was weak and ungodly. It was not a good situation on either front. This is the circumstance. But not only that, did you notice that they actually named the cliffs? It said there was two cliffs. One was called Bozez, the other was called Sena. And I don't know about you, it's like, well, that's kind of interesting. They named their cliffs. I don't know, do you name your cliffs? Actually, I think we do. Let me tell you what I mean by that. So, there's two cliffs that are a barrier to how things are going to work in this. Jonathan and anybody in the army is going to have to navigate these two cliffs and how they're put together if they're going to get anywhere. It's going to dictate how they move forward and where they can go through and all this. These two cliffs, they feel like a barrier. And I predict that each of us in this room have cliffs that we can name in our lives. Circumstances that will hinder us. They might be things like your job is a cliff that you can name, and you feel like it hinders you from being on a journey that you're supposed to be on. Maybe it's your income. Maybe it's your health. Maybe the cliffs in your life have the names of people. Hopefully not people sitting right next to you right now. But our cliffs have names. We will actually find out in this story that the cliffs that feel like hindrances, hurdles, barriers to us can be used of God to be about accomplishing His purpose. God's amazing that way. The things that we curse, the things that we name with despite, can actually be used of God. But this was the context, the place of conquest. What a difficult, horrible challenge that the people of Israel faced. But let's move from the place of conquest to the place of a leader. Now, I just want to say this because some of you go, I don't have to listen to the next part because I'm not a leader. Every single person in this room is a leader in some form or another. And what do I mean by that? Every single person in this room has influence in some way or another, and the ability to serve God in some way or another. It might be that you have influence in your family. It might be influence with your neighbors. It might be influence with a sports team. It might be influence at your workplace. In one way or another, could be influence here at church, whether you have an official position and a paycheck or whether you're a volunteer. In one way or another, you have a place of impact and influence, and you get to be a leader. Well, in the midst of difficult circumstances, so we've talked about the Israelites had their difficult place of conquest, their difficult circumstances. So what would be like for us? Well, we have difficulty in conquest as well, don't we? As churches, we can forever go, our building's not big enough, our facilities aren't new enough, our parking lot's not good enough, our money is not enough, we don't have enough of a revenue stream to accomplish the ministries we want. We don't have enough workers to serve. Our resources are low. We need more children's workers. We need more youth workers. We need more nursery workers. We need more every workers. We need all these things. Sometimes we can feel like leadership is wonderful. Sometimes we might have questions. Sometimes people come through. Sometimes they don't. And sometimes we have challenges, the cliffs, even in our own local churches. These are the places of conquest. The things that can actually make us feel defeated and like we just want to give up and run away. Or maybe like Jonathan, a leader in a place of leadership, you can discover that what seems like the most significant challenges become the seedbed for the most amazing work of God. That's the kind of God we have. So what does Jonathan do? What's Jonathan like as a leader in all of this? A couple things stand out. First, Jonathan believed the promises. I don't know what it was like for him sleeping out with his armor bearer that night, under the stars, maybe just a rock for a pillow. And did he look up and think back to the stories of the first five books of Moses and the amazing thing God's did? Did he think of some of the stories of the seasons of the judges? You can read about it in the book we call Judges. And he would have known these stories. Did he maybe remember things like the story of how one man with a stick in the time of the judges, just a stick and the power of God, took down 600 Philistines. And Jonathan thought, you know, God does amazing work, not just then, but now. And maybe some of you need to hear that God doesn't only work. I mean, this church started 50 years ago. Can you imagine the faith of the people who started this church? What amazing risk. Some of you are around. Some of you don't want to admit you're around, because that dates you. But you're a part of this. And the amazing seasons, there's been other seasons of risk-taking and trust. And the power of God has shown itself at Bucyrus First Alliance Church, or in your own life. But I want you to know that Jonathan had to come to grips with God wasn't just a God of powerful work in the past. He would be a God of powerful work today. And that God may want to use you in the place of a leader. And God laid something on Jonathan's heart that he ought to move into. And I just wonder if God might lay something on your heart. Maybe you as an individual, maybe you as a family or a married couple, maybe you as a church, in the things that he wants you to do. Jonathan believed the promises, and he believed the power of God. Not only that, Jonathan actually was one who would take risk. He was willing to step out, and he was okay if it didn't work out well for him. If you read this story and read between the lines, you realize that Jonathan had a certain expectation as he took a risk. He fully expected that God would show up and God would do amazing things. And he did not know if he would live the day through to see it. He didn't necessarily believe that he would live. He did believe that God would win. And he understood that it wasn't about him and his comfort. It was about God and his glory. And Jonathan was willing to step out and do whatever it took. That's exactly what he does. He was willing to go it alone if necessary. Did you notice that he didn't tell his father? Why didn't he tell his father? It's actually a bit of going against authority there. He just went and did what he did. Here's what I think. I think he knew that the faithless would try to stop faith-filled risk. And sadly today, Pam and I, we travel around to churches all over a whole region, 70 churches in 3 states, and I see this in certain places where the people of church sometimes, well-intentioned, will stomp on the faith-filled risk of people who are hearing the voice of God and seeking to obey. Why? We'll say things like, oh, that doesn't feel comfortable to me. Oh, that feels like we're not ready for that yet. Maybe someday. Oh, that feels like we shouldn't do that just now. We've never done it that way. We should keep doing it the way we've always done it. And we stomp on the faith and obedience of people who are hearing the voice of God. Now, that would never happen at Bucyrus First Alliance, but I've seen it in some other churches. And I would just want to say that we need to be careful that we're never like the Sauls of the world who would try to squelch the active, faith-filled risk of people like Jonathan. Jonathan didn't tell his dad because he knew his dad would try to rein him back. He also didn't tell the rest of the army because he really didn't want to make it about him and he didn't want to make it about his glory. It was a humble thing that he was doing. He was just going to be obedient to God and not drag others into that. So he was willing to go it alone if necessary as he moved forward. He was willing to be active while others rested and whined, as dad's drinking iced tea under the pomegranate tree. And here's a fascinating thing for me. I see in this that Jonathan's view of God determined how he would act. Catch that? This is an important statement. Jonathan's view of God determined what he would do or not do, how he would act. By the way, the same is true of his father Saul. Saul had a different perspective of God. It led to his inaction. And it's true for every single one of us in this room. Our perspective of God will influence, will impact, will determine how we will act in life. It's always the case. It was true for Jonathan in this story. Jonathan knew that he needed to advance in the midst of uncertainty. He was unwilling to just hide and survive. He wanted to see God's people and God's glory thrive. He also knew this, because I don't know if you're like me, but I like to have everything all figured out. You ever like to have it all? God, I'll obey you if you tell me exactly what this is going to look like and how it's going to finish. And Jonathan didn't have that at all. He just knew he was supposed to step out. And he knew that God would show the next step as he took the next step. As he takes a step to here, then he would know where to step to here. And God would show him and lead him forward. But God didn't show him exactly where it would end. But he knew that God would show him as he stepped out. And that's the obedience that we need to have when we hear the voice of God and take a faith-filled risk. You won't see it all. You won't know exactly where the finish line's at or what it's going to look like. You might think you know, and then you might find yourself surprised. But as you obey, God will show you what to do next. He's amazingly good that way. Jonathan understood this, and he knew he needed to step out. He needed to show himself. He said to his armor bearer, hey, we're going to step out from behind the rocks, and we're going to show ourselves, right? And here's what he knew, because he actually said this. When he stepped out, there was no turning back. Up until the moment that they stepped out from behind the rock and stepped out, and those Philistine soldiers up there saw them, they could bail out on this thing. The minute they showed themselves, there's going to be a fight. It's going to happen. And Jonathan didn't know how the fight would go. He knew God would be glorified. He knew God would win in the end. But he didn't know how this would go. How do I know that? He said it to his armor bearer. He's like, hey, we're going to show ourselves. We're going to have a fight at that point. There's no going back. And if they say, stay there, and we're going to stay here, and they're going to come down, we're going to have a fight. But he didn't have any confidence that if those Philistines came down to them, that they would win. But he did have confidence that if the Philistines said, come up here to us, they would win. They were going to fight either here or there, down or up. They're going to fight. They're going to have to do it. They show themselves. There's no turning back. And the same is true for us as we walk this journey with Jesus. As God speaks to us, the Spirit leads us, there comes a point that we have to step out from behind the rock and we show ourselves. There's no turning back. You're going to obey God. And you're going to find out what's going to happen. I don't promise that it goes easy for you. I don't promise that you'll survive it. I do promise this. God will be glorified and his kingdom will advance. I can guarantee that. And I'd love to tell you that, like, you'll be the poster person for everything else the rest of your life. I can't tell you that. I don't know. We might actually be at your memorial service. I don't know. I don't know how that goes. So there is the place of conquest, there is the place of leadership, and there's also the place of followership. I told you that every single one in this room is a leader. You also all get to be followers. Even the lead leader is a follower. Everyone in this room is a follower at some level or another. So who's the follower in this? Well, this is the armor bearer, right? The armor bearer who walks with Jonathan. Did you catch his name? Yeah, I didn't either. Matter of fact, we don't have his name. He's anonymous. Don't you hate that about things in life sometimes? Like, hey, did you hear the story of what Bob and that other guy did? This is basically it. Here's a story of Jonathan's great conquest. Oh, and by the way, there was an armor bearer with him. Are you okay with being a part of God's work if your name's not in lights? If you don't get credit for it? If nobody knows your name, if you're behind the scenes and they didn't even really know you were there, even though you knew how important your role was, would you be okay with that? Are you okay in the chess game of God's work with being a pawn, not the bishop or the rook? Are you okay with that? The armor bearer was. Now, sometimes we think it says that he was a young man, so you think, oh, he had just like some kid carrying around his shield. That would be a misunderstanding of this, okay? This was a young special forces officer. How do I know that? The king's son doesn't just have a kid carrying around his shield. The king's son has one of the best warriors in the whole army. To protect his life, he is the heir to the throne. Not just anybody gets to be in this role. He is one of the best fighters in their whole military. But he's nameless. He's a young guy. He's an armor bearer. But did you catch what happens in this armor bearer? First, he understood his place with authority. In America, we don't like authority so much. Our nation was birthed in rebellion against authority, and it's been a part of our DNA ever since. We're actually pretty good at practicing rebellion. By the way, spiritually, it was a part of our DNA since the Garden of Eden, right? So this young armor bearer understood. The king says God's spoken and he's moving that way. The armor bearer doesn't get to go to the gym and work out. The armor bearer is going to be right with his leader every step of the way. And can I say to you as followers, and whether it's that you someday need to say this to your children, whether someday you need to say it to your spouse or someone that you're dating, whether it's something you need to say to somebody in the youth ministry here or somebody who's a faithful servant in the children's work or whatever it is, or your own pastor, to walk up to somebody as they're obeying God and just say, Pastor Bill, I want you to know I'm with you heart and soul. That's what the armor bearer did, right? Says, Jonathan, do what's in your heart. Do you think the guy had some questions about it? I think he did. He's like tens of thousands of Philistine soldiers out there. The armor bearer doesn't even have a weapon, not a sword anyway, right? And Jonathan is going to go to battle, and this guy's like, we're outnumbered, we're doomed. But none of that matters. He sees a leader who's obedient to the voice of God, and he says, I'm with you, heart and soul. We need more followers like that in the family of God who will be willing to stand with, to be the cheerleaders, the champions, the assistants, the helpers, the partners of those who are being obedient to the things that God's doing. And did you catch what happened? They walk into this, and here's how God works. Because now we come to the place of God, right? There's a place of the sovereignty of God. You have a difficult context, just like we have in our world today. We have place of godly leadership, we have a place of godly followership, and then we have the place of a sovereign God. God works out things in amazing ways. So, in a battle, what do you want, the high ground or the low ground? High ground, right? But God flips things on its head. He does this regularly. So what happens in this story? Jonathan understood intuitively that God likes to flip things on his head. So he's like, hey, here's what we're going to do. We're going to step out from behind the rock. We're going to show ourselves. If they say, come up here to us, then we're going to take that as a sign. God's going to give them our hand. We're going to do that. You go, that makes no sense. That's backward thinking. But Jonathan understood that God's not bound by the conventions of man's thinking. God has all kinds of things he can do. And catch, remember I told you about those two cliffs that seemed to be a problem, seemed to be an obstacle, so much so that they gave them names. By the way, the name Bozez and Sena means basically thorn and slippery. Rough translation of both of those. And so I was like, well, that sounds fun. How are they going to navigate this and get up there? Well, I don't know for sure. The Bible doesn't tell us the details, but I'm just going to speculate a little bit. It says it's a steep pass between these two cliffs. They're going to climb. It says Jonathan climbed using his hands and feet. Well, that's not really ideal, is it? And they climbed up this narrow pass to the outpost up top, armor bearer behind him. Well, sometimes the things that seem like an obstacle, like a steep climb between a narrow pass, can actually be used to your advantage. The Philistines were eager, I think, to want to fight this guy. He looks like a general. Maybe he's the king's son, royalty. They all wanted to be the one who could go back to base camp and go, look who I killed, and hold up his head, all right? But only one person can meet him in the pass at a time. So there's the first guy, and God gives power, and Jonathan's a good fighter, and Jonathan knocks him down. And the armor bearer comes along behind him, and as each guy comes down, they're not quite dead yet, and there they are, and they're the armor bearer comes in. He does a little whack-a-mole thing, right? You know, and he's just taking care of this. And eventually, he's got a sword too. He's taken a Philistine sword and he's going to use that. So they got weaponry now. And when all is said and done, there they get to the top, and there's about 20 men all together in just this little small backyard area. And by God's grace, they take them all down. And we learn that our sovereign God is sovereign over the immediate things that we face. Jonathan's armor bearer had a fight with 20 men. That's their immediate issue. God is sovereignly good to walk with us in the middle of those things. But God's also sovereignly good over the big picture. Remember the big picture? The Philistine army is oppressing the land. There's tens of thousands of them. They outnumber the sand of the seashore. And something amazing happens here. We don't know how much of it is natural and then used by God and how much of it's supernatural, caused by God. It doesn't really matter. It's all the same. It's got God's fingerprints all over it. It says that there was a panic that began to spread through the Philistine army. If you read the verses after verse 14 where I stopped, there's a panic and the Philistine army starts to run and they start to actually fight each other and they're just freaked out. As a matter of fact, the whole ground is shaking because tens of thousands of men are running, and they don't really know why. They just know that somebody started it, and you got crowd panic. And they're running for their lives. As a matter of fact, they start to feel the rumbling over with the 600 Jewish soldiers that are with Saul under the pomegranate tree. And he's like, he goes to his spies, his scouts, and says, "What's going on?" And they're like, "We don't really know, but they're all running. Maybe we should go do something about that." And they immediately do roll call, and they find out Jonathan's armor bearer aren't there. And they grab whatever they have, and they go running, and great is the victory. There's more to the story than that, but there's basic things that's a part of this. God was sovereign over the immediate need right in front of them, and God is sovereign over the big picture. He's an amazing multitasker. He can pull all this off. This is the God that we have. Finally, I would just say this. This might sound like a silly sentence, but it actually means a lot to me out of this story, and we'll end with this and then pray. God advances through advancement. You go, well, that's a lame sentence. You use the same word twice, and it seems like it's redundant. And it's not. God advances through advancement. People tend to want to see God do amazing things and then we'll join in. And God says, no, it's not going to work that way. You start advancing and then watch what I do to advance the kingdom. Step out from behind the rock and show yourself. Be obedient to me. Take leadership. Join and be a good follower, heart and soul. Because God can save, whether by many or by few. He is an amazing God. But he tends to not work until we obey him. So God advances through advancement. Obey and watch what he will do. We wish that we could watch what he would do so we would obey, and it doesn't go that way. And I don't know what God may say to some of you in this room today, but I have a thought that some of you, before the day or week is out, you need to take the first steps of advancing. You need to step out from behind the rock. You already know what it is. God's laid something on your heart. It might be going to apologize to somebody that you really don't want to apologize to, about making right a relationship that's been broken and hurt. It might be about stepping up and helping someone who feels rather unlovely to you and you're not really sure. It's going to be messy. It's going to be a problem. But you know God wants you to carry love of Jesus into that. It could be to start a new program or a ministry. It could be to wade into a certain neighborhood. It could be simply to invite a coworker or your next door neighbors over to your house for brownies and ice cream and just start to be their friend. Whatever it would be, the Spirit of God is nudging you and you need to step out from behind the rock. And some of you, as you hear others talking about this in the coming days and weeks, you need to step up, put an arm on a shoulder and just say, I just want you to know I'm with you heart and soul. Do what God has laid on your heart. We will not hinder your step of faith. As a matter of fact, we'll be there to walk with you. And you will find that God is sovereign over the details and sovereign over the big picture. And you can't outdo God. He's so amazing. Let me pray for you. Heavenly Father, thank you that you're this kind of a God. I mean, how could that be? It's just so amazing that you're this kind of a God, that you do amazing things. It wasn't just Jonathan's day so many years ago. You actually still work the same way because you're still the same God. So Lord, would you do the kind of things that only you can do? And would you spur and stir something here? I thank you for the people of previous days and weeks and months and years at First Alliance Church in Bucyrus who were obedient. They advanced and saw you bring the advancement and the glory. They found you sufficient and powerful and good and sovereign. And I pray that that legacy of the past will continue to be the legacy built on into the future for your honor and glory. And we'll give you the praise in Jesus' name. Amen.